Hello, Vet Blast podcast listeners. Mark your calendars for Fetch Long Beach happening this December 6th through the 8th. Join us for 3 days of top-tier veterinarian continuing education, all while soaking in the California sunshine. At Fetch Long Beach, our attendees come first. That's why we offer personalized learning opportunities, complimentary meals, and a dedicated staff ready to support you every step of the way. So if you are looking for that perfect year-end CE opportunity, Fetch Long Beach is the place to be.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. I have the honor to hang out with my dog's veterinary neurologist. She's wonderful, from North Star Vets, Dr. Ann Chauvet. How are you, my friend?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. Exciting.
Oh, yeah. I'm so honored to have you on. And I'm so happy to see you without an emergency.
Yeah, that's always a good thing for a dachshund owner.
Right. Absolutely. And so to our listeners, we're going to be chatting a lot about the neuro exam, just basic things that we see in general practitioners and general practice of what we do, and some other fun little tidbits that Dr. is going to share with us, and a little bit of information about our wonderful colleague here. Dr. Chauvet is of French origin and raised in Equatorial Africa in Canada. She graduated from the University of Saskatchewan Western College of Veterinary Medicine in Saskatoon in 1990. She completed a one-year small animal rotating internship at the University of Illinois and pursued a residency in neurology, neurosurgery at the University of California from 1991-93. While on staff at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Chauvet created the basic science course in veterinary comparative neurology and neurosurgery that is now known as Brain Camp. She later moved to Florida's Gulf Coast, where she grew her practice until its sale in 2016. And since, Dr. Chauvet has worked in practice in both Canada and in the U.S. Wow, it's amazing. She's trained in rehabilitation and certified in hyperbaric medicine. Over her career, Dr. Chauvet has obtained multiple businesses and veterinary awards, served on ACVAM and non-for-profit local committees and boards, lectured in multiple countries, authored and co-authored numerous articles and book chapters, created educational videos and rehabilitation for clients, and even written a children's book. She embraces integrating medicine styles to support the need of the patient. So wonderful work you do and continue to do in this profession. Love it.
Well, I do too. So it's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start by asking about, you know, what does a neurologist neurosurgeon do exactly? So what are the day-to-day activities of what you do?
So it's actually a very well-rounded specialty. There are not too many specialties that are so well-rounded. Ophthalmology is another one, but where we actually take care of everything within our field. So when people think about when we're doing MRIs, radiology for neurology, basically, or neurosurgery, when we're doing electrodiagnostic, which is little needles in your muscle to figure out what your nerves and muscles are doing, whether we're doing a plain physical neurological exam, or taking the patient to surgery, and as well doing pathology. So we are trained to even look at our spinal taps and all. So that's the roundedness of it all. Some specialty in neurology actually train for only neurology. So they will not include the surgical part, but it will include everything else. But overall, currently in the United States of America, most residencies include the whole shabam.
Yeah, it's quite a bit. It really is. I'm always intrigued when I'm seeing you all interpret the MRIs and identifying lesions and, you know, forebrain disease, whatever that may look like. So it's pretty fascinating. So, you know, our listeners are veterinary professionals, and probably the most common thing that you and I see, and also as a dachshund dad myself, is interretinal disc disease. So, you know, what are some things that we as general practitioners should be mindful of, because I'm sure we get this question. I know I do. I get it all the time, is to ship or to not ship, you know, and, you know, what do we exactly do to help stabilize and manage their pain?
So this is one of my favorite topics to teach practitioners. So number one, what is IVDD, intervertebral disc disease? We often will look at radiographs and see some little whitening between vertebrae and say, oh, this dog is IVDD. So we have to define, what do we mean? Do we mean that radiographically has calcified disc? or does it mean that he's actually clinical? And I'm going to stick to the clinical part, right? So seeing changes on radiograph does not mean the dog is clinical for it. So we have to evaluate the clinical part. So disc disease that is clinical is usually going to present with some level of discomfort, some level of pain, and then we start having weakness or paresis. That's the name we use. So the dogs can be walking, and then they can start being wobbly and weak, but still walking. And then they get to the point where they're still moving their little legs and wagging the tail, which we've all seen in our famous dachshunds and Frenchies, but they can't push their little butt off the ground. And then eventually they end up not being able to move at all. This becomes, the further I go into that list, the more you have to ship. You have to be ready to go, hey, I'm not going to be able to manage this at this point. When they start losing movement, then they can lose sensation in the skin, and then sensation in the toe. When we talk sensation, real important for veterinarian, it's not pulling the leg back. It's actually turning around and wanting to bite us when we pinch those toes, and that's a deep pain response. So for us as general practitioners, what is important to retain? Retain that if they're walking, you can probably treat medically. The exception might be the French bulldog, which often decides to go south very quickly. So we have to be a bit more proactive with that one. But otherwise, dachshunds are golden. When they're walking, 85%, 90% of them will never have to see a scalpel blade. So knowing that, then we have to anchor ourselves on the medical treatment. What does that mean? Number one, single most important thing to do is box them up. Cage rest. And it doesn't mean confined to one room. It means just that, cage rest, a space big enough for them to lay in any direction, have their food, their water, and that's where they are. Then you can top it off with those anti-inflammatories. So here goes the battle, right? Do we use non-steroidals? Do we use steroid? Well, I'm a neurologist, so I'm always going to tell you steroids are better, because the non-steroidals in my book have a lot more side effects for the doses we use. And it will also then interfere if I go to surgery, a lot more bleeding, a lot more complications with that. The only time really that I lean towards non-steroidals, if the main sign is pain and there's no proprioceptive deficit, there's no weakness really, then I'll be quite okay with that, because it does add much better analgesia in addition to usually your pain medication, your gabapentin or amantadine or what you'll decide to use for managing pain. But really the biggest thing you can do along with that is cage them, and how long? Solid 7 to 10 days, 14 days. Yeah, they get to go outside, they get to go around and all and check for urination and all, but they still need to be confined. I always tell people, think of it as a sprained wrist or a sprained ankle. You're not going to go and take up tennis the next morning. You're going to slowly rehab it, right? And then there's all the holistic things you can do as well to help your client. You can go ahead and do laser, acupuncture. Those things are tremendously helpful. So what can you do in a practice when you have a down dog that you think you're going to need to send off to people like me? I'd say make sure you get your blood work, make sure you get your chest x-rays, because you're going to always think tumor on your list, always cancer. And the last thing you want to do is be shipping a patient and a client to drive half an hour, and they get there only to find out you have metastasis. So the radiographs for me are far more useful for looking for neoplasia or lysis in the bone. To do plain x-ray of the spine to look for disc doesn't matter too much to me, because it doesn't mean it's the same location. The MRI often will tell me a different location than what the radiographs suspect us to be doing. So stay focused on your patient. Don't stay focused on the radiographs. Focus on the state of your patient. Give them a chance to medically recover. And if in 24, 48 hours, you have no improvement, or God forbid they're worsened, then be ready to ship. So don't wait the 2 weeks to recheck them. Recheck them much sooner.
Right. And I think setting that expectation to clients about if they go down.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. I tell people, I have this little saying. I said, when you put your dog in a cage and you decide you're going to take him out because he looks good, or something is going to be good, or you think you feel sorry for your dog, just make sure you have $8,000 cash on the top of the cage.
Right.
And they tend to get that. You know, they're like, wow, this is what it's going to cost me if I have to go to surgery. Yeah. So try to train your clients to be respectful of that time frame and that physical restraint, that because it's hard for owners. The dogs whine. It's so difficult for them.
Yeah. And do you think that some dogs are more predisposed to just going down regardless, though, and regardless of like,
oh, yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, French bulldogs are notorious. So we've got so used to, I've been doing this for 34 years, right? So we
Yeah.
got so used to dachshunds. When I started, that was a popular breed, right? The little wiener dog. But now we've been very much kept busy by French bulldogs. And one of the things we know is French bulldogs start going down, you better hurry because overnight they'll lose their feeling and it can be quite dramatic. And once you lose that deep pain, the odds of recuperation are pretty low. French bulldogs, I tell people, are a little bit more like a big dog spine, even though it's all compacted. You know, it's like a German Shepherd spine put in a trash compactor almost because it's been all compacted together. But the spine itself is big as far as diameter
Yeah.
and it's very large vessels. So surgically, we often encounter a tremendous amount of hemorrhage accompanying that disc that creates a volume of compression. So you have to know that that bleeding, the disc can keep herniating, but the bleeding keeps happening. And so that's what gets the doom of those dogs. And it'll spread for two, three, four spaces. So they usually quite involve surgeries for Frenchies.
Wow. I've never asked a neurologist this, but I mean, you've been in this field a long time and you've seen the breed change a little bit more, like the French
Yes.
Bulldog. So when you're in surgery, was there a point in your career where you're like, what's happening? Like,
Yeah.
what does it look just anatomically different from when you first started practicing as a neurologist to where you are now?
Oh, absolutely. I see a dachshund and I have the dance. I'm so happy. I'm like,
Yeah.
ooh, it's gonna be in and out, in and out. I'm gonna be
Yeah.
so happy. It's gonna go well. Everything's predictable. Yeah. So by all means, we were spoiled. And now with all those exotic looking breeds and a lot of these
Yes.
bulldogish looking breeds, right? A
Yeah.
lot of they're trying to breed the French bulldog with a poodle doing trying to do that. I'm like, oh my goodness. And I don't know what that's gonna come with, right?
Right.
We used to see a lot more Labradors with type 2 disc, a lot more things. That has sort of phased away because the popular breeds are what's going to dominate our field. And the popular breeds are often going to be right now a lot of pitties, right? We get a lot of calcified disc and pit bulls as well. And then we get, of course, the famous French bulldog.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's pivot a little bit and let's chat about brain tumors in dogs. What do we know, generally speaking, about them? And you know, what are some things that we should be looking for on a neuro exam or physical exam that might be setting us off to be like, oh, there might be something going wrong upstairs?
So the big thing I tell veterinarians, just remember when you're thinking about brain tumors, they don't usually happen unless you have a certain age. Now I'm gonna have a caveat in that I've had the youngest one I've had was 3.5 year old with a little Jack Russell. But usually it's 4 years and older. So if you have a 2.5 year old little dog that begins seizuring, so therefore has a cortical lesion in the brain, the odds of that being a brain tumor are pretty darn low to none. If you have a 9 year old pit bull, you have a much greater chance of having a brain tumor over idiopathic epilepsy. So you're going to make your decisions on whether you work up or not, or how far you can push your client for that. So the signs you're going to see are dependent entirely on the anatomy. So if I section out the brain, the front is going to be usually seizures. The cortex is very prone to seizures, particularly in what we call the piriform lobe, which is the part of the brain that on each side of the brain will turn around, curl towards the midbrain. That's very prone to seizure. And it's a lovely place for gliomas to lodge themselves in all those pit bulls, bulldogs. They tend to have a lot of gliomas. Boxers, famous for it as well. So that's an area that often gets seizures. Then you look at things like midbrain. We see a lot of midbrain problems with pituitary tumors. Those are more of the dog that's very dull, aimless walking, eyes going to kind of start running into things. And often people label it for senility. Be careful with that senility label, because if you overlook it, it might be too late for us to be able to help the patient. And then you've got the back part of the brain, which is where you have the coordination, your cerebellum, the high stepping dogs, the intention tremors, and then you can have, of course, the vestibular, all the loss of balance, and of course, all the since the brain feeds to the back legs and the back and front legs, you're going to have proprioceptive deficits. So when you remember that forebrain lesions will give you contralateral proprioceptive deficits, and caudal fossa, vestibular, cerebellar will give you ipsilateral, so same side proprioceptive deficit. So you want to look for that. Seizures, forebrain, mentation, aimless walking, not being able to track things, midbrain. vestibular, loss of balance, back part of the brain. So that's kind of where you're going to be looking for these things. But depending on the age and the breed, I would push any dog 4 years and above, I would push for any signs of brain to go to MR, because brain tumors are common. The earlier we catch them, the more we can help them, whether it's going to be surgical removal, plus or minus radiation, plus or minus chemo, or radiation or chemo. There are many things we can do now, and there are even research projects we can guide people to. So I would not automatically write off these dogs as, well, it has a brain tumor, there's nothing you're going to do.
Yeah.
It's not always true.
Yeah. I'm curious to get your perspective on this too, because as a general practitioner, I see so many things that I feel like, please don't be a brain tumor. Because maybe it's not, I'll talk to the clients. I was like, maybe it's not, let's start with, the blood work and the basic.
Right.
What are some things on your end though? What are some things that you see that get referred that are literally directed towards a brain tumor? What are some things that are classic that you could share with the listeners?
So the big one will be the midbrain.
Okay.
So when I get vestibular disease, it could be a lot of things. Could be outside the brain, inside the brain, could be a lot of things. When I get seizures, could be a lot of things as well. But when I get midbrain lesions, when I get signs of dogs that when you drop a cotton ball on one side of the face or the other, they can't track it, or they only circle wide to one side. They don't seem to be paying attention to where they are until they hit a wall, and it takes them a while to get out of it.
Yes.
It could still be meningitis, meningoencephalitis, could still be GME and all, but chances are you got to go after that mass, whatever mass is, right?
Yeah. Speaking of GME, we were just at our local conference here, and they're seeing a lot of it lately. It seems to be like GME is something that we're seeing quite a bit. Either we're doing better in terms of diagnosing it from the general practitioner standpoint to the neurologist. What are your thoughts on that?
You mean whether we're seeing more GME?
Yeah.
From my experience, I don't think so. My personal caseload, no. But we are what I'm seeing a lot more of coming to Jersey, because I've been different places, is that you see a lot more tick-borne or tick-related inflammatory disorders here, by all means.
Yeah, especially ticks in this area. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So it's like everywhere you go, right? So when I was in Arizona, when a dog has a neurological issue, the first thing you say is valley fever.
Yeah.
And otherwise, this thing is valley fever, right? So you hunt valley fever and run hopefully into something else. When you come here, it's a lot of tick-borne disease. When you go to Florida, you got this really weird fungus that can light up as well. So you kind of have to adapt to the scenery.
Yeah. You touched on this earlier, and something that we see, I think, a lot in general practice is this, I'm just going to use air quotes to the listeners, but this old dog vestibular syndrome we see, like they come in and they're just, they look like they had one too many, and, sometimes it goes away. Sometimes they have a permanent head tilt, maybe they can't afford to see you, the neurologist or whatnot. What are some things that we as general practitioners can be on the alert for and help manage these guys?
I'm really glad you asked. That's also a lovely topic. And there's some very simple tricks for general practitioners to get a hold of and hang on to. So first of all, deciding whether it's likely to be in the brain or not. That's the big one, right? You want to know if you're going to have to get diagnostic or what you can tell the owner about whether it's in the brain, the problem is in the brain or not. So to be in the brain, you have to look for things like change in mentation, altered mentation. You have to look at things like proprioceptive deficits. You have to look at things as other cranial nerve deficits, and I'll exclude cranial nerve 7 because that one also is located in the by the bulla. You have to look at signs of cerebellar disease. You have to look at signs of what we call disconjugate nystagmus. So a lot of people teach you that the nystagmus abnormal eye movement is continuous abnormal eye movement is up and down, vertical, that means central. That's not true. Not in all cases. But however, if one eye is going one direction and the other is going the other direction or a different direction, that's going to be central. So we call it disconjugate, verb and noun, non-conjugating. So that one's central as well. And the one that's really, you have to remember where ipsy and contralateral go, if when the clinical signs don't make sense, example, head tilt to the right means right side. Nystagmus with fast face to the right means left side. So that doesn't make sense. We call that paradoxical. So now you're in the brain again. So if you can remember that, then you're going to be at least decide, am I looking at something peripheral or something within the brain. And peripheral, you're going to have most likely, rarely tumors, but most likely idiopathic. I don't like old dog vestibular name, but so I'll call it idiopathic, or otitis. So you can at least begin treating otitis systemically and then monitor. If the patients have recurrent signs, so sometimes they get better and then they recur again within a short period or more frequently, I tell people at that point in time you need to scan. Most of the time, these vertigos or idiopathic vestibular disease are going to be one time, maybe a second time much later. And then the last thing I want to say about vestibular, do check the blood pressure. We do see a lot of hypertension with blood pressure issues.
Oh, yeah, good to know. Absolutely. Okay. So as we pivot out a little bit, this is just more getting to know you. I always like to know about our colleagues. So what made you get interested in veterinary neurology?
Oh, I was not. It picked me. It
Like
was
choosing the wand.
interestingly enough, in school, it was what I excelled in, but I was not interested in it. When I did my internship, I chose a small animal because I wanted to do surgery. And my dreams of GEMS area got squashed when I realized there's not a lot of surgery in the GEMS area world. But certainly, I did not speak the lingo of the horses. So there was a lot of stuff that pushed me into small animal surgery. And I applied to 19 residencies.
Wow.
Only one of them was not surgery. And I applied to that one because my mentor in Illinois said, you must apply to Davis. And I looked at him like, I don't want to do neuro. I
Yeah.
did not rank them high, and that's what I got. So, in the end of the day, you know what they say, doesn't matter where you want to go, life is going to shove you where you need to be. And
Right.
that's exactly what happened. And it's been a blessing. I love it. I
Oh.
absolutely love the roundedness of neurology. I love the mystery of it, especially when you talk cat neurology.
Yeah.
And I think it's a constant learning curve. It's fabulous.
It
I
really is.
what a pleasure.
And I could share from my perspective, just going to the conferences, they pack the house. They really do. I think general practitioners, I don't want to ever say that they don't know. I think they're genuinely curious. They love to brush up. They actively participate in the conversation. And whenever I see and I sit in those sessions, it's very engaging. It really is. And the videos speak volumes to trying to neurolocalize a lesion or understanding gait analysis. Is it orthopedic or is it neurologic? So I think that's what makes veterinary medicine fun. It's like to me, in neurology, it's like solving a mystery,
Oh, it is, and I remember Dr. Parker, that said mentor, coming in when I was an intern and looking at a Great Dane from across the room and just doing two little taps on the dog after, and he knew what was there. Or the dog's walking down the hallway and he'd say, oh, that's what it is. And we all looked at him like, oh, is this voodoo?
Right.
And now I see dogs on the hallway or cats, and I'm like, oh, that's where it is. I
Yeah.
90% of my exam is done before I put my hands on the patient.
Wow.
It's absolutely, for me, it's marvelous. It's like,
That's
wow,
incredible.
the intuition you build, right? And with
Yes.
neurology, everything is so hidden
Yeah.
that you have to have sort of that building blocks of your knowledge over time to kind of, I guess we call it intuition, but you kind of build that skill, that art of
Yes.
neurology.
Yeah, it's truly an art. And I'm sure you've seen many animals in your day. So what is the most exotic animal that you've done surgery on?
I've been very fortunate to see a lot of exotics. So I would say a gorilla in Wisconsin was wonderful with
Okay.
neuropathy. Yeah, Milwaukee Zoo gorilla. But probably my most memorable one is a lioness named Ola that herniated a calcified disc and was dragging part of a rescue, zoo rescues. And so we actually did surgery and she walked again. And she ended up dying of what most lions in captivity die of is heart disease later on. But
Yeah.
yeah, she actually walked again. Took
Oh.
two OR tables end to end to take care of that lion in surgery. It's very big.
Yeah, I can
Fun.
imagine. My gosh, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was actually. It was one of you feel very privileged when you have
Yes.
the gift of life to be able to share a space with such animals. I feel very honored and privileged.
You know, I love that you said that, Anne, because sometimes we get disenchanted in our profession. We feel like we might have lost the spark. And I share that a lot when I give lectures too, is like it's truly a gift and an honor to be providing, to being the best advocate and giving a
It
voice to
is.
the voiceless, and especially with what you're doing with all these different species you're seeing. And I get choked up talking about this because I've been on the other side to see a dog, my own dogs, like go and become paralyzed. And to see the great gift and work that you as neurologists do, and to see them go down the hallway and get that wiggle bite going down the hallway, it just warms my heart. You really are just a blessing in this profession. So thank you.
We're lucky, and I'd like to tidbit to all my GPs out there. Neurology is scary. Scary for you guys, but it's even more scary for the client because understanding what's going on, I mean, we go to lectures and classes, they have no clue. They just have to relate to what they know of humans. But it's very unknown. It's in sitting
Yeah.
all in a box. So we have to remember to be extremely empathetic, extremely human. In that, not only the fear of the bill, but also the fear of what's the outcome, And
Yeah.
then hopefully we can be genuinely human with our clients and be there to support them in their own decision.
Absolutely. Yep. Lead with empathy and compassion for sure. And I understand you have a website too, so tell us about your website.
My website for the, you mean the clinic or the leisure?
You have the laser. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. So we have built a website so we can go ahead and make access to client to have a laser. It's a class four laser. It's a low level in the sense of the wattage. It's not too high watt, so clients can use it very safely. So yeah, we have vnslasers.com, and then if people go on it, they should use the code NSV, North Star Vet, NSV, to be able to access that. And go look on it. I mean, it's got tremendous amount of information about laser. That's another topic. What's a
Yeah.
laser? What does it do? It's like, oh, well, that's the gamut of lasers is
So many.
huge. So therapeutic lasers, their helpfulness with pain management. We talked about that with disc disease, with stem cells, stimulation and promotion of the healing process, like in wounds and post-op, is tremendously
Excellent.
helpful. Matter of fact, I think they're I remember the days when class four came out and people thought we were going to burn a hole through things.
Yeah.
And now they're everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere they are. They really are. Well, Dr. Anne Shova, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for all the great work that you do, my friend.
You're very welcome. It has been a pleasure. I appreciate this. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And if you want to learn more about Anne and the folks at North Star Vets, you can head on over to northstarvets.com. Wonderful friends over there as well. Thank you for tuning in to the Vet Blast podcast. Don't forget to rate this episode, and we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay possum.